Amp's finishing up his belly dancing routine. Welcome back to Hour 2 of Inside Track. Bruce and Eber here live with producer Tom. Charles Heller may be somewhere in the building.
Lurking about.
We're broadcasting from the Perfection Auto Works Studio, sponsored by Wilkinson Wealth Management, Essential Pest, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and Perfection Auto Works, where Mike makes autos great again. We promise to give you a special secret guest who will join us shortly. Before we do, Eb and I, we want to give thanks to all of you out there, Renee and Mark and Charles and Paul and a whole bunch of other people who call here a lot.
Len,
that's right, yeah. Want to give thanks to all of you out there who listen at home, maybe doing chores at work or driving, getting around, getting ready for Christmas giving. All of you who listen to the show, it's gratifying to know that there's a lot of you out there, and you tune in every Saturday with all of the other distractions going on. Thanks for listening to Inside Track. We appreciate you, Eb.
Hey, special Thanksgiving wishes go to our great show supporters, Jamie and Craig at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Eric Rudin and his crew at Essential Pest, and our newest sponsor, Mike Emery from Perfection Auto Works, where he and his team make autos great again.
Lastly, but not leastly, a big thank you to Eb Wilkinson from Wilkinson Wealth Management. Gun owners trust him with their money, including me. Now on to our special secret guest, a man you know by his distinctive voice, positive message, and patriotism. Cue Tom.
Now, the story of the Pilgrims begins in the early part of the 17th century. The Church of England under King James I was persecuting anyone and everybody who did not recognize the church's absolute civil and spiritual authority, actually the state. Now, those who challenged the ecclesiastical authority and those who believed strongly in freedom of worship were hunted down. It's in England in the 1600s. They were hunted down, they were imprisoned, sometimes executed for what they believed. So a group of separatists, people that didn't want any part of this, fled first to Holland. They liked wooden shoes and cheese. They established a community. They were there for 11 years. After 11 years, about 40 of these separatists who liked wooden shoes and cheese agreed to make a perilous journey to the New World. They had heard about it. Some new exciting place hadn't been developed. They knew that they were going to face hardship. Hardship like you and I don't know. And I'm not preaching to you. I'm just telling you, we don't know the hardship these people endured. We can't. We are way too advanced now. People who lived in the 1600s would not believe life today. Try to explain flight, jet travel. They wouldn't understand it. They knew they were facing hardship. But paramount importance to them was living freely and worshiping God according to the dictates of their own consciences, their own beliefs. That's what they were denied the freedom to do in England. So, August 1st, 1620, the Mayflower set sail. There were a total of 102 passengers, including 40 of these separatists, the Pilgrims. There were just 40 of them. They were led by a man named William Bradford. Remember his name. On the journey across the Atlantic, you talk about something that had to be frightening and scary. The Mayflower was not much bigger than a 50-foot boat. 102 people on it. On the journey, William Bradford set up an agreement, the contract, if you will, that established just and equal laws for all members, all 40 members of this pilgrim community. Didn't matter what their religious beliefs were. These were the laws they were all agreeing to live by. Now, where did these laws, these ideas come from. We're talking about the Mayflower Compact is what Bradford wrote. The Mayflower Compact derived from the Bible. The Pilgrims were a people completely steeped in the Bible, Old and New Testaments. They were a devoutly religious people. No matter what else is said about them, and even that is denied, they were devoutly religious. They looked to the ancient Israelites for much of their example, and because of the biblical precedent set forth in Scripture, they never doubted, because of their faith in God, that their experiment would work. They never doubted they would get to the New World. They never doubted that once they got there, they would thrive. The journey was long. It was arduous. It was dangerous. And when they finally landed, when the Pilgrims finally landed in New England in November, according to William Bradford's detailed journal, they found a cold, barren, desolate wilderness. Imagine New England as it exists today as nothing but rocks, forest, undeveloped nature in November and getting colder. There were no friends to greet. There was no shelter of any kind other than what, you know, hiding under a tree. There was nothing, folks. It was desolate. There were no hotels. There were no inns. There were no places to clean up. There were no houses. This was real hardship. The sacrifice that they had made for the freedom to worship was just beginning. During that first winter, remember they arrive in November, during that first winter, half of them, including William Bradford's own wife, died of starvation, of sickness, exposure to the elements. Now we're getting close to what you were taught in school. When spring finally came, and by the way, writing that doesn't do it justice. Spring didn't just finally came. It was a survival. It was an act of survival that you and I cannot possibly relate to or understand. American Special Forces can. Military people who've been trained can understand what the Pilgrims were. You and I can't. We've never done anything like that first winter in the New World. They survived it. Spring finally came. They did meet the Indians, the Native Americans who were there, who did help them in planting corn and fishing for cod. They showed them where the beavers were so the beavers could be skinned for coats, other things. You animal rights people are not going to like some of this story, but it happened. But even at this, even with this degree of assistance from the Indians and Native Americans, there wasn't any prosperity yet. They had the Mayflower Compact. They had these laws they were living by, but there was no prosperity yet. I wonder why. Now, this is important to understand here, folks, because this is where modern American history lessons end, with the Indians teaching the Pilgrims how to eat, how to fish, how to skin beavers and all that. That's where it ends. And that's the feel-good story. But that doesn't even get close to the true story. You know, Thanksgiving is actually explained in some textbooks as a holiday for which the Pilgrims gave thanks to the Indians for saving their lives. It wasn't that. That happened, but Thanksgiving was a devout expression of gratitude. The Pilgrims to God for their survival and everything that was a part of it. Now, here's the part that has been omitted. The original contract the Pilgrims entered into in Holland, they had sponsors. They didn't have the money to do this trip on their own. They had sponsors. There were merchant sponsors in London and in Holland. And these merchant sponsors demanded that everything that the Pilgrims produced in the New World would go into a common store. A single bank, if you will. And that each member of the Pilgrim community was entitled to one share. So everybody had an equal share of whatever was in that bank. All of the land they cleared, all of the houses they built, belonged to that bank, to the community as well. And they were going to distribute it equally because they were going to be fair. So all of the land that they cleared and all the houses they built belonged to everybody, belonged to the community, belonged to the bank, belonged to the common store. Nobody owned anything. They just had an equal share in it. It was a commune. The Pilgrims established a commune, essentially. Forerunner of the communes we saw in the 60s and 70s out in California. They even had their own organic vegetables, by the way. Yep, the Pilgrims, forerunners in organic vegetables. Of course, what else could there be? No such thing as processed anything back then. Now, William Bradford, who had become the governor of the colony because he was the leader, recognized that this wasn't going to work. This was costly and destructive, and it just wasn't working. It was collectivism. It was socialism. It wasn't working. That first winter had taken a lot of lives. The manpower was greatly reduced. So William Bradford decided to take bold action, which I will describe when we get back here. So I want to get back to where we left off. William Bradford, the governor of the Pilgrim community, saw that none of this was working. The Mayflower Compact was not working. Giving everybody a single share of stock in the common store, in the common bank, was not working. Collectivism. It was as costly and destructive to the Pilgrims as it is and has been to anybody who has ever tried it. So Bradford decided to scrub it. He threw it out and took bold action. He assigned a plot of land to each family. Every family was given a plot of land. They could work it, manage it however they wanted to. If they just wanted to sit on it, get fat, dumb, happy, and lazy, they could. If they wanted to develop it, if they wanted to grow corn, whatever on it, they could. If they wanted to build on it, they could do that. If they wanted to turn it into a quasi-business, they could do whatever they wanted to do with it. He turned loose the power of the capitalist marketplace. Long before Karl Marx was even born, long before Karl Marx was a sperm cell in his father's dreams, the Pilgrims had discovered and experimented with what could only be described as socialism, and they found that it didn't work. Now, it wasn't called that then, but that's exactly what it was. Everybody was given an equal share. You know what happened? Nobody did anything. There was no incentive. Nothing worked. Nothing happened. What Bradford and his community found was that the most creative and industrious people had no incentive to work any harder than anybody else did, unless they could utilize the power of personal motivation. But while most of the rest of the world's been experimenting with socialism for over 100 years longer now, trying to refine it, perfect it, reinvent it, the Pilgrims decided early on to scrap it permanently. What Bradford wrote about this experiment should be in every school child's history lesson. If it were, we might prevent so much suffering. We might have prevented this election if the true story of Thanksgiving had been taught for years and years and years. And I'll tell you what Bradford wrote and how they fixed it when we get back after this. So William Bradford, after putting everybody in a common store, the Mayflower Compact, they wanted to be fair. They wanted everybody to have one common share of stock, and everything that happened that the Pilgrims produced, and it bombed. It didn't work. There was no prosperity. There was no creativity because there was no incentive. Here's what Bradford wrote about the failure. For this community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent. They were not happy, in other words. This community was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort. In other words, nobody worked. The way they set it up killed and discouraged work. There was no need. For young men that were most able and fit for labor and service, sat around and did nothing, should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without being paid for it. They said, why do that? So they didn't. It was thought to be injustice. Why should you work for other people when you can't work for yourself? What's the point? So you hear what he was saying here, folks? The Pilgrims found that people could not be expected to do their best work without some incentive. So what did they try? What did Bradford's Pilgrim community try next? They unharnessed the power of free enterprise. They invoked capitalism, the principle of private property, all the way back in the 1400s. It was incredible. Every family was assigned its own plot of land, and they could do with it whatever they wanted to do. Bradford wrote, this had very good success, for it made all hands industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. So when profit was introduced, when the opportunity to prosper was introduced, it went gangbusters. That, my friends, is the essence of the true story of Thanksgiving. This is where it gets really good. If you're laboring under the misconception that I was taught in school, they set up trading posts, they exchanged goods with the Indians after they had enjoyed this prosperity. It was not the Indians that brought them prosperity, and it's not said to insult anybody. The Indians assisted them on their arrival, undeniably. But what led to prosperity for these original settlers was a discovery that the common store failed, socialism didn't work when they introduced what turns out to be capitalism. They didn't have the name for it, but when they turned loose individual incentive, keep what you produce, sell what you don't need, they went crazy. This is not something they were taught by anybody but self-experience. It was not the Indians. None of this is said to put anybody down. Don't misunderstand. The Indians did a lot of things that helped them, which I'll get to in just a second, but it was their own industriousness. They set up trading posts, they exchanged goods with the Indians, they sold stuff to them. And those profits allowed them to pay off the debts of their sponsors in London and in Holland. And you know what? The success of that colony, after they had abandoned socialism and tried what was essentially capitalism, the word spread throughout the old world of this massive amount of prosperity that was there for the taking in the new world. And guess what happened? The new world was flooded with new arrivals. The success and the prosperity of the Plymouth settlement attracted more Europeans and began what came to be known as the Great Puritan Migration. And all it took was prosperity. And the word spreading across the Atlantic Ocean of how there was prosperity and it was there for the taking. All you had to do was get there and give it a shot. The lesson is, the true story of Thanksgiving is that William Bradford and his pilgrim community were thanking God for the blessings on their community after the first miserable winter of a documented failure brought on by their attempt at fairness and equality, which was socialism. It didn't work. Only when they abandoned it did it work. And I need to say again, because I don't want people to be misunderstood, get noses out of joint. The Native Americans, the indigenous peoples, the Indians, whatever you want to call them, they were of considerable assistance, and they were friendly when the pilgrims arrived. But they had little, if anything, to do with the prosperity that occurred, because that was the result of Bradford and the pilgrim leadership deciding to change their structure according to the Mayflower Compact. Now, the Indians assisted, naturally, I can't deny it. I mean, they taught them how to fish and this kind of thing that they didn't know how to do, and that led them to be productive, undeniably so. But it was the pilgrim community itself which experienced this massive prosperity, the word of which spread all the way back to the old world, Europe, across the Atlantic Ocean. Now, I mentioned earlier that the Federalist has a story on all this. And in it, they describe much of what we did in the second book that dealt with this, the children's book, Rush Revere and the Brave Pilgrims. And that book goes into great detail about how the Indians did provide assistance and what kind of assistance it was, how valuable it was, and how crucial it was. And in Rush Revere and the Brave Pilgrims, we focus on a Native American by the name of Squanto. Now, as I told you, during that first winter, 1620, only 44 of the original 102 pilgrims survived. They had an elected governor by the name of John Carver. And it was an Indian by the name of Squanto who came to their rescue. And this is, as I say, explored in great detail in Rush Revere and the Brave Pilgrims. Now, Squanto was no ordinary native. Early settlers in 1610 captured him and sold him into slavery. A group of Catholic friars ended up freeing him, brought him to England, where he learned to speak English. In 1618, serving as an interpreter on an English ship, he was brought back to the New World. It was Squanto, who is a famous Native American in his own right, in the pilgrim story. It was Squanto who taught the pilgrims how to plant, how to fish, how to skin beavers. It was Squanto who brokered a peace treaty between the pilgrims and other Indian tribes. There was more than one tribe of Indians. It was not copacetic. It was not friendly and at one with nature. It was not anything like the multiculturalists would have you believe. There were squabbles, there were power struggles, turf battles. It was human. The Indians, the pilgrims, everybody was scrambling for power, for survival. Survivability was the name of the game, and it was not guaranteed. Now, many of the pilgrims literally believed that God had sent Squanto to save them. And they believe, pilgrims believe, that without Squanto, they never would have survived or thrived. And they experienced a tremendous harvest in 1621. And that's the big gathering that is taught in the history books. The native Indians and the pilgrims joined together for a huge feast, which is the foundational story of the Thanksgiving story that's taught in public schools. But again, that is not the real story of Thanksgiving. That's the textbook brain. It did happen, but it's so much more than that. And I love taking the opportunity every year to explain the truth, especially now, given how this election has apparently, allegedly fallen out. Because even as the Federalist side, this is so great that the story is spreading. One of the most important legacies of the early settlers is that they experimented with socialism in the 1620s and it did not work. Private property rights, personal responsibility saved the Plymouth colony from extinction and laid the economic foundation for the free and prosperous nation that we all enjoy today. And that's exactly right.
We'll be right back.
Essential Pest Control leaves with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
Long ago, my grandfather told me,
I was asleep on the night before Christmas. I heard a noise. Who are you?
The ghost of Carburetor's Past.
Ghost of Humbug.
Silence, Ebenezer, or I'll backfire on you.
I hate backfiring carburetors. What do you want?
You must rescue us and all our computerized, fuel-injected progeny from Quirky Loop on the corner, Ebenezer Emery.
But how?
Do a free 26-point inspection, Ebenezer.
Okay, so my grandfather's secret is out. Merry Christmas, everybody, and come get your car work done at Perfection Auto Works, 323-8650. That's 323-8650, and PerfectionAutoWorks.com.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911. Welcome back to Inside Track. Eb here, looking across the studio at Bruce with Tom and Charles helping out today. Our guest until the end of the hour is friend of the show, distinguished author and columnist Scott Powell from the Discovery Institute. He joins us from his home this afternoon. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's wonderful to be with you. And I know we're going to talk about Thanksgiving, even though it's 2 days later, but it's a very big story, I'll tell you. So,
well, have you dusted off from your Thanksgiving road trip yet?
Yeah, I did. We just got back about a half an hour ago. It was a long couple of days' drive. We were up in the Panhandle of Florida.
So nice.
Drove about, I guess about 500 miles, from where we were to home. So we're here.
Well, earlier today, Bruce and I read A Desolate Land from the Wall Street Journal about the pilgrims landing at Plymouth.
Yeah.
Talk to us about Thanksgiving and your message Americans should not forget about with the pilgrims' progress on the North American continent.
Well, I think it would be really good, since it's after Thanksgiving, to frame this conversation. I want the audience to be thinking about why Thanksgiving is important. Yes, it's important to give thanks because that's what that holiday was all about. It was a Thanksgiving feast between the pilgrims and the Indians. But there's much more as far as Americans go to the pilgrim story. Thanksgiving is only one part of that story. And when we think about how America really has been in decline since the 1960s, we really want to rediscover those principles that made us a great nation right from the very beginning, right from the Pilgrims' arrival and what they did to 170 years later, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitutional Convention that created this amazing form of government that propelled the United States in less than 200 years to becoming the world superpower. How was that possible? It was possible because of the American people. The American people were empowered under a rule of law to pursue their dreams and to be, you know, to be creative, dynamic, to explore and discover new things. And so we created this enormous wealth. But we also had a moral heritage behind that. We have largely lost that heritage. And so the Pilgrim story is so kind of important. The first thing about the Pilgrims, there are really five things about their achievements. But the first was that of the many groups of settlers who came to America, it was only the Pilgrims who were singularly motivated by a spiritual quest for religious freedom. You know, one that really had its origin in the Protestant Reformation, and the Protestant Reformation came about because of people, you know, having access to the Bible. During the Catholic years, no one really read the Bible, so they didn't really understand the real essence of Christ's message.
And the Pope didn't want them to read it.
And the popes didn't really want them to read it, absolutely. But as God would have it, the discovery of the printing press and the distribution of Bibles, everything changed. And so the separatists were originally a group of people in England that kind of felt that the Church of England had carried over a lot of Catholic traditions, and there was politicization of the church. And they really felt that they were called to live their lives according to the Bible. And so they petitioned to form a new church. The crown rejected that. And then they became known and persecuted. Several of the Pilgrims actually spent time in jail in Great Britain until they all fled to Holland, where they lived for about 10 or 11 years. And during that time of living in Holland, the Jamestown colony was established in Jamestown, Virginia. And the Pilgrims heard about it, and they heard about its ultimate success. Of course, in the beginning, it was a colony really destined to failure because it was only men that colonized Jamestown. There were no women, so there could be no families, no procreation, no permanence to that colony at all. But they heard that they had gone there. They petitioned the government, and it was really the Virginia Company that said, hey, if you want to go to the New World, we will give you a charter for new land. So they got a charter, and they got funding. They got two ships, the Mayflower and the Speedwell. And so they decided to set out. Now, they got a late start because the Speedwell was a leaky ship, and they turned back twice to get it repaired. And finally, they had to abandon the Speedwell. And so they got 102 people on the Mayflower. It's only a 92-foot ship. And really, there was the lower deck, like the bilge area, and there was the middle deck, which is where they all had to be, and then there was the upper deck. So it was a precarious crossing, very crowded, and of course they encountered bad weather because they got a late start because of the Speedwell. They lost a whole month of you know, transatlantic time, so they didn't leave until late September, right during the, you know, the hurricane season, and indeed they encountered some very bad weather. One of the storms they had battered the ship so badly that it broke the main beam, and the whole ship could have collapsed, but some of those Pilgrims had foresight that they were going to build homes, and they had what was known as a house jack that would raise beams up, and so they got that house jack out under this broken beam in the ship and were able to shore it all up and continue on their voyage. But there was a mutiny going on by the time they really made landfall. You know, their food was running out, some was spoiling. And people should remember that it was not just the separatists, the Christians, who were on the ship, but about they composed a little over half of the people on the Mayflower. There were about 102 total, And it was the non-separatists, if you will, the non-religious, that sort of were not ready to go forward. They didn't know where they were. They didn't know what were they in. So they wanted to turn back. And it was the pilgrims that decided, hey, if we're going to survive, we've got to get everybody together on the same page. And let's establish a compact that everyone can agree to, both the Christians and the non-Christians. And that was the Mayflower Compact. And every man on that ship signed it. And it was understood that you have to sign this in order for us, to depart the ship and make a settlement. But we all want to recognize that we may be in hostile ground. Fortunately, the place where they settled was Plymouth, Massachusetts. And near Plymouth was an Indian tribe, the Patuxent, who were actually favorably disposed to the newcomers from England. And so that Mayflower Compact was their first achievement. The second achievement was and what was also providential, we have to understand that God's hand was in all of this. And there were two Indians. There were Samoset and Squanto, and they both, and it's too long a story to introduce here, but they both could speak English. So the fate of the pilgrims was greatly helped because these two Indians, one of whom had spent considerable time in England, could speak English. And so there was a translator between the chief Sachem, who was known as Massasoit, and he was of the Wampanoag tribe. It was a very big tribe, and the Patuxents were sort of a division of this great larger tribe. And it was because of Squanto and Samoset's ability to communicate with Massasoit and suggest that they create a treaty. So they created a treaty, a peace treaty between the Indians and the Plymouth settlers. That treaty lasted 50 years, and there was cooperation. Squanto and Samoset helped the Indians learn how to plant new crops. They'd never seen corn before, for instance. And so they learned how to fish, how to hunt, and how to survive. But the first winter was brutal. And over about half the pilgrims died in that very first winter. And so they were greatly diminished in size, but they proceeded to go on. And they were, under the charter of the Virginia Company, they were to plant and share all the harvests, communally. So their farming was sort of a socialistic approach to farming. It didn't work out too well. The harvest was very meager. But they nonetheless thought we should give thanks to God on that very first harvest. That was in the fall of 1621. And so they invited the Indians, who had treated them so well, to join in that harvest. And luckily, the Indians, and the Indians came in about twice the numbers of the pilgrims. So they about 100 Indians showed up for this feast, and they had 5 deer, they had all kinds of fowl, they had all kinds of harvest, they had enough food, more than enough food for everyone, for more than just a single meal. In fact, their festivities went on for 3 days.
Wow.
So that was the second accomplishment was this peace treaty. And really the Thanksgiving was, I guess we could call it the third achievement that they made, that they made peace with the Indians and they worked together well. The fourth achievement of the pilgrims was they continued in that second season. So after Thanksgiving, they had their next season. That would have been that would have been the harvest season of 1622, and they continued in this socialistic, collectivistic farming arrangement. But William Bradford, who was one of the elders of the community, said, the problem with this problem is, and I'm quoting him out of his diary, the slackers showed up late for work, but everybody was happy to claim their equal share, and production only decreased.
Sounds familiar.
It sounds very familiar. So, in fact, later, after that second season under socialistic approach to farming, he said he had seen enough, and he recorded that the system was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment. that would have been to their benefit and comfort. So before the 1623 season, Bradford scrapped the socialist farming and replaced it with private ownership of land for each of the families, and as a result of becoming responsible for their own welfare and gaining the freedom to choose which crops to grow. So because they were involved in trade right from the beginning, even amongst the families, some would grow this crop, another would grow that crop, and they would trade. So that changed everything, and the productivity of those farms greatly surged. So if you have a question, you know, just ask me. I've covered a lot of ground here.
We've got Charles here that has a question. Charles?
Okay, great, Charles. I don't think I have a
mic yet. Hang on just a second. Wrong mic. Keep going.
Do you think, there we go. You think that that led to the first NFL strike, that socialism?
Oh, my God.
I don't know. But it's just significant, and most people don't know these stories. I mean, to have the very first...
We learned them in school.
Colony
we learned them in
America
school, Scott.
To reject socialism. Why would we ever entertain it ever again? And yet we're a very highly socialized nation today.
Scott, we learn about these in elementary school. They haven't been taught in probably 50 years.
It's unbelievable.
Since about 63. Yeah, and when you think about it, Scott, this sending the Mayflower to the New World was like going to the moon.
Oh, and, it was. You're absolutely right.
And, I mean, these people had to completely fend for themselves. I mean, the initial miracle was just living, making it there, right? I mean, after what you described, it was just horrific.
And half did not.
Absolutely.
And half did not survive the first year, if I'm correct in my history.
Yeah, about 42.
I mean, you had that harrowing crossing where they lost more than half their people. And then they didn't lose half their people in crossing the Atlantic. There were no losses among the Mayflower separatists. One crewman who was very critical of the Christian separatists, and we've made a lot of fun of them. He in one of the storms, he was washed overboard and never found again.
Yeah.
So
that's amazing. That's God saying, lot, but, hold my beer and watch this.
Yeah, amazing what happens when God frowns, huh?
Right. So the fifth factor, so we've been through five of these unique factors of the pilgrims. The fifth factor that distinguished the pilgrims was their model relational behavior. And of course, they had to have tolerance to keep relative harmony within their diverse community. And when I say diverse, it was very diverse. You had believers and non-believers. You had a diversity of people. But they didn't just have tolerance, but they also looked outwardly to serve and help others. It was actually in March of 1623, it came to be known that Massasoit, he was the chief sachem, was on the brink of death from an unknown illness. And it was senior pilgrim elder Edward Winslow, who was somewhat of a medicinal, natural doctor, and also an elder, a Christian elder in the community, he decided he should go and find Massasoit and see what he could do. So he immediately set out on a 40-mile journey to administer medicinal broth, natural herbs, and to pray over Massasoit. And astonishingly, within days, Massasoit made a full recovery, and Massasoit was so thankful, and this is recorded by Edward Winslow. He said, "Now I see the English are my friends and love me, and whilst I live, I will never forget this kindness they have showed me." So the fifth thing that's significant about the pilgrims is that it isn't enough just to be tolerant, but we're called to serve others, and our whole... When we think about America's success, it has largely been driven by that very attitude of serving other people. I mean, capitalism is not a system of greed. It's a system where you identify the needs of society and you begin to fill those needs by being productive, by
service.
Crops, in the case of agriculture, to new gadgets and widgets to solve problems. And when America practiced this, our economy grew faster than any other economy in human history, and America became the number one superpower by World War One, really, which is an incredible accomplishment. And I would liken it to a stock car going from zero, that is stationary, to 60 miles an hour in less than 3 seconds. And in the big scheme of history, that rapid economic growth was much like that.
And yet, with this great story, Scott, to this generation and probably the last two generations before this, there's almost been scorn and mockery made of the pilgrims coming to this country. They're diminished in many different stories. Squanto is almost a punchline. Why is it that such a series of events and things that occurred, which are so fundamental to the country that we eventually became, why are these things kept from the public?
Well, I think we have to go back to the early 20th century, back to probably, Wilson's era and John Dewey, who was, involved, I think, in the Wilson administration. But Wilson was a globalist, and he was, I know that he gave nice words, words of affirming his, Christian belief, but he was really, it was really more of a secular globalist. Dewey was, he was a non-Christian. He was hostile to Christianity. And Dewey really shaped the early education of the United States. He had a huge role in the direction that public schools began to take. So the separation from our great history really probably started in the 1920s and through the 30s, and it's just proceeded ever since. And it's really an age-old battle between good and evil, between belief in God and non-belief. And when you don't believe in God, then what do you have? You make yourself a god, and that of course makes you a self-centered person. And that's where, of course, evil comes into being, when we pursue only our own interests. And then some personality types, they become megalomaniacs. I mean, this is the problem of politics, is that people who tend to become leaders get corrupted by power. And the genius of the American system was that it divided power. And so there were checks and balances, and not just between the three branches of government, but between the federal government and the state government. And in the early days, the states would have had more power in America than the federal government. But that got corrupted, and the federal government really usurped more and more of the states' rights until what we have today.
They gave it up, Scott. They gave it up.
What's that?
They actually gave it up willingly in some respects to get government guilt.
I think so too.
And they gave up on God, and that's what we're seeing in parts of the Democratic Party right now. Remember at the convention a couple of conventions ago, three times they denied God.
Right.
Where did that sound familiar?
I know. Well, look at what's happened in America since we've gone in that direction. That's the thing that everyone can see. We know our history pre-1960s, even though the process had already started back in Wilson's day. Basically, the family was intact, not just the white family unit.
The black families.
But black family. Black
very
families
much so.
Were very much intact. Divorce rates were very low. Family life isn't easy. And, when people are committed to it, which is marriage is a covenant relationship. And by the way, the Mayflower Compact was seen as a covenant agreement that they made before God.
Absolutely.
They would be committed to each other, that they would watch each other's back, they would make all decisions democratically, one person, one vote, and that was a covenant that they made. And so that covenant was really the foundation, was sort of the cornerstone of our country, and the Constitution, which came much later, was still much the same, a covenant relationship. But
hey,
when
Scott,
we leave
I hate
God
to do
out
this.
Of the equation... Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Finish up. We're close to the end.
Well, when you leave God out of the equation, we find left to his own devices, man can really screw things up. And that's kind of where we are right now. But I think a spiritual revival is in the works, and it's going to come on more and more because people can see the emptiness.
Scott, I hate to do it. We're at the end of our time.
We're going in.
We're at the end of that time. Thank you so much for joining us. How do our listeners follow you?
Well, I'm not much of a social media guy, but you can follow all my writings on at the Discovery Institute. I think the best way I can close is the book I wrote, Rediscovering America, has not only this pilgrim story in more detail, but all the other stories that made America great. And
Scott,
it was the bestseller, number one for 8 weeks on Amazon. So go to Amazon, read the reviews, and if you like it, go get a copy.
You got it. Hey, Scott Powell, thanks for joining us. You were great,
absolutely,
as always. On behalf of myself, co-host Bruce Ash, producer Tom Fairbanks, Charles Heller, and all of us here at KVIA, best wishes. We look forward to seeing you again in 166 hours.
Jamie Kipper and her father, Gary Kipper, from Tucson Iron and Metal. What are they going to see when they come through the gates?
So when they come on in, they'll see our building up front. People have free rein to then go out and look in the yard. So it's not a typical scrapyard with a ton of big machinery. We have a couple of forklifts around, but that's about it, just to help move material. So when you come in, it's all organized by material, whether it's square tubing, angle iron, roofing, and then there is a pile in the back, which is still organized and easy to get through, but that's stuff that comes over from the scrap. So we're unique in that we get stuff in from the scrap, which a lot of artists and people will like or reuse, whether it's a sink that someone needs for their house. We sell literally anything made of metal.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Perfection Auto Works.
Ho, ho.
Who is this?
Ho, ho, ho.
Oh, Santa. It's good to hear from you again.
Ho, ho, yes. Small collision with the lead power unit.
You ran over Rudolph?
Oh, minor front end damage. Can you fix his nose light?
Hang on just a minute. Hello, Merles? Do you guys have a nose bulb for an 01 Reindeer? No, in red. Thanks. Santa, it'll be here in about 15 minutes. By the way, did you do the 26-point inspection I told you about last year?
Say, now you were starting to sound like Mrs.
You're missing out.
This is Mike Emery of Perfection Auto Works. We specialize in Porsche, Audi, Volkswagen, Volvo, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and
Reindeer. Call 323-8650. That's 323-8650.
This is Ed Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.